Hey everyone, welcome to another exciting episode of the Scratch the Track podcast presented by the Dude and Grim Show and co-produced by Mr. Ivy EST. I'm the Dude.
And I am Grim. And today we are going to take a little trip back to the 90s and talk about an album that changed a lot of things at that time. Goes by the handle of Nevermind by Nirvana.
Whew. Well, I do mind, Grim. I mind greatly.
Oh.
Well, Grim, one of the questions when I was doing kind of research and everything on this album that kind of like popped into my head was, this was a very influential album, you know, obviously back in the 90s. I mean, I think that absolutely goes without saying, but I am going to say it. But do you feel like this album still matters? Like, is it one? I think it has stood the test of time, but do you think it still matters? Do you think it's still influential in the music we see, in the culture we have? I'm not sure it is. I'm kind of on the fence there.
I wish it was. I think it should be. And maybe to some bands, there are parts of it. Because if we want to look at some new bands that actually play rock music, look at the first impression we did a few weeks ago about the band Geese. The range of influence, sure, is something like in something that like what they put out with 3D Country was so great that maybe it does matter to a band like that. But I think in terms of just like your mainstream average sort of stuff, no, I sadly don't think a lot of people care about the 90s. Is a joke, I think, to a lot of people. 90s rock is. Which is the same thing I would say about 80s rock. So I guess it kind of makes sense. But to those of us who grew up at the time, it's not a joke. It's good music. And rock music actually made a comeback, unlike now.
Yeah, it's certainly not
rock era.
The rock era. It's not the leading genre in popular music. Now,
it's nerds with drum machines now.
Yeah, there's that. Well, even like a band like Tame Impala, which was like, oh, sweet,
was awesome, a rock band.
We're gonna have like rock and everything, and now it's just I don't know.
Yeah, he was like, you know, I need a drum machine, which I got one sitting right here. They can be great tools, but I there's something about basing everything you do off that I find hard to. I still like guitar driven rock music, maybe not all the time, but. It, you know, it has a place and should.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think obviously it it mattered in years ago, and I'll kind of, you know, when it came out in, I guess, what is this, 91. And I'm going to go back and I'm going to give you some dates and stuff here with some other albums to put it in a little historical context. But it is interesting because it was so influential and it mattered so much, I think, you know, in what it did for the music scene back then. But yeah, definitely now, man, it's hard to say. Like, I mean, to me, it still matters. But let me ask you this, because you just asked me this question before we started. Do I own this on vinyl? And you know what? I do not. And it's not because I can't get it. It's not because they're not repressing it. It is widely available.
And that's why I don't own it.
Yeah,
that's precisely why, because there are enough things that I want.
So is Dark Side of the Moon, though, right?
Oh,
so is Sgt. Pepper, so is Abbey Road.
I actually had copies of all those. I rebought Dark Side, but you're right. But the reason with Nevermind is there's a lot of 90s albums that I haven't bought. And I want them, and there'll be a point when I pick them up, but I just, you know that it's going to be out there. You just know that it's going to be out there. And recently they released some $250 Enormo Dome edition, which I don't really need that for this, or for most records. It would take a very special album for me to want to spend that kind of money on one thing, one album.
And as great as this album is, it's not that type of an album for you, huh?
No. No, it isn't. Okay. Not that kind of money. I'd love to have it. I mean, dude, I own In Utero. But that's actually harder to find.
Yeah, it kind of is. I mean,
and it's my favorite.
Yeah, I would say side note. Yeah, it's my favorite as well. But side note, I have the remix version from 2013, and I completely regret that purchase.
Did not hear good things about that one.
I mean, it just, you know, your ears are so used to hearing the way a song sounds, and to adjust things and take levels up and down, it sounds just out of balance.
Yeah.
And that it's not necessarily means it's bad. They're still great songs, but my ears can like not accept sort of what I'm hearing. But,
now, speaking of that, I just think it's interesting to note is that this album became, I mean, they're obviously their breakthrough, right? It became the breakthrough, I think, in popular culture for all this kind of music. I mean, it was like when this showed up on MTV, I remember I made a tape and I didn't have a direct tape to tape recorder. So I put it in a room by itself facing another tape player and played one and recorded another. Just because I wanted the song that fucking bad. And I wasn't able to just like go to the store and buy the cassette single.
Oh, dude, that is awesome, man.
Yes. Yeah. And it was just like, the tape was just like the song over and over.
Yeah. That's really cool. Well, to kind of build off that, Grim, you know, you talked about it kind of changing the musical landscape, which it did. Like, I feel like this is the marker or the turning point that everybody kind of points to. But I want to put this in context because, and I don't want to take credit or significance away from this album at all, but dude, there were already bands making great grunge rock music at that point.
Oh,
music
sure.
Here's the thing. You know, music was already changing. It's not that, oh, this album came out and then everybody else is like, oh, okay, well, let's start making music like this now. Check this out. This album, Nevermind, came out September 24th, 1991. 1 month before that, before this album came out, Pearl Jam 10 came out. Two weeks after this album, I got a lineup for you, Grim. 2 weeks after this album, pretty much the same time, Soundgarden's Bad Moto Finger. 3 months before this album came out, Smashing Pumpkins' Gish. 4 months before this album came out, Temple of the Dog. And 1 full year before this album came out, Alice in Chains' Facelift was released.
And actually, so, 2 full years before this came out, Jane's Addiction, Ritual, Dalo, Habitual came out.
There you go.
There was stuff out there, but there was, and it's funny because you brought up 10. And 10, although 10 kind of fits in with that, 10 and Nevermind are still, to me, if grunge rock is its own spectrum, they're on different sides. Because Nevermind has, granted, okay, you got your hit single, but let's get out of that hit single and just go to other points on the album. There is some just like noisy, nasty, mean sounding shit on this album. And I just, the 10 does not sound like it. To me.
Yeah.
But it's in the same vein. It was a shift in popular music. Like, I remember watching, there was a show on Netflix that was about Motley Crue. And Motley Crue was like trying to revive to come out with something else after they were kind of washed up and drugged out. And as they were leaving like the studio or something, there was a billboard in LA for Pearl Jam's 10. And I was like, well, that's kind of telling. Yeah, so it definitely was like one of those agents of change, for sure.
It was, and I think the thing is like again, not taking anything away from this album, but what this album did is people were starting to make this music. This music was coming up. This sort of new music sound and movement. What this did is it brought it put everybody on a pedestal, and because then all of a sudden you're like, okay, well, Nirvana's doing well, and that's what people want to hear. So now we're going to start checking out, you know, giving these bands that might not have had a chance.
Yeah, otherwise. Sure.
The record companies, the radio stations, they may not have gravitated towards that sound. Because, dude, here's some other albums that came out in 1991 that were very good, very successful, But man, after like this sort of movement, you didn't hear a ton from them anymore. And we have Spin Doctors, Pocket Full of Kryptonite, Genesis, one. We Can't Dance, Guns N' Roses, Use Your Illusion 1 and 2, Metallica's Black Album, and U2's Octoon Baby. Now, I mean, U2 is one of those bands that has kind of survived, but dude, like Guns N' Roses, I mean,
That pretty much was it.
They had their own demise, I think, internally. But I really feel like, you know, what Nirvana and what Nevermind did was it pretty much cut the head off of like hair metal bands like that and curb stomped it at the same time. Like it was just out of popular music. Now, a band like Guns N' Roses and Metallica, though, like the elite of the elite, those can kind of, you know, survive and hang around a bit longer. But, you know, there's always nerve endings.
I do have to ask a fair question, though, that unless you're a diehard Metallica fan, do you give a shit about anything after the Black Album?
Yeah, I was going to say probably not.
I mean, because, again, there was that classic lineup change and you got rid of Newstead eventually. And it just it was just a changing point. But I think what Nirvana did, especially with this album, that made it so unique and something that was looked at is just that it was like he wrote songs that had sort of pop sensibility to them, but they were ugly and they were they still had a lot of dissonance. It says that Cobain, I guess, was quoted as saying that he wanted Nevermind's material to sound like the Knack and the Bay City Rollers getting molested by Black Flag and Black Sabbath, which is awesome.
Sounds like something he would say.
Yeah.
So I certainly believe that. But it is so, dude, and I didn't appreciate this as much when I was younger. It's so funny to go back and listen to this album now. And it's almost like kind of a cliche, I guess, because a lot of people have said this is nothing new. But dude, how poppy this album is.
Some of those
changes in riffs and the vocal patterns. But it's like, hey, let's put a loud distorted guitar over it. Right. And like, it's going to be pop, but let's mask it.
And like I said, don't downplay the dissonance that he used in certain spots, because I remember that's one of the things that fascinated me about it is like I didn't understand what he was doing like with some of those chord changes like in Bloom. Like there's just some interesting dissonant choices that he uses, but they go together in a way that like you can almost mask it as something else, something that like still kind of makes sense, you know.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
And his tone, which I haven't read up on it extensively, but I remember my friend telling me at the time that like all he ever used was a Boss DS1 distortion pedal, which is like the most basic pedal you could get from Boss that was distortion. But the tone that he came out with in his guitar was like kind of set the stage for what was going to happen in with the 90s and that sound.
Yeah. No, that definitely makes a lot of sense. Definitely makes a lot of sense. So I don't know, man. You want to kind of start getting into, talking about the album a little more. First off, there is a phenomenal documentary on the classic albums.
Yeah.
On this album. And what's so great about it, I mean, obviously they cover kind of the whole history of kind of the band up to this point and then the recording of the album. But dude, being able to go into the studio with Butch Vig and him at the control board, man, and being able to like play tracks and songs and mute things, it is just, it's so awesome to be able to hear just isolated parts of, you know, the songs and whatnot. I think it's fantastic.
I do like that too.
How they do that.
And it's nice because as you listen to an album like this, as opposed to going back to something from like the 60s or maybe even early 70s, like everything's on its own.
own track.
You didn't have to like dump stuff or make any, you know, make any choices that you couldn't come back from. So that is really cool. Oh,
yeah. Here's the track with the, you know, the drums and the bass and
whatever else.
Right. Yeah. It's like, oh, okay, cool. It's like, man, being able just to separate out like just one set of background vocals or like, hey, here's the double, you know, here's the doubled background vocals of Kurt and Dave, you know, like it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Now I think one thing that we got to talk about too is that the way this became a major label release was sort of interesting because Sub Pop who was their record label prior to was having some major financial troubles, and thankfully they didn't go out of business. But like, instead of fearing getting dropped from their label, they like did one better, and we're kind of like, oh, we'll go find something on our own.
Yeah, it's just like cut out the middleman.
Yeah,
essentially what they did was is they had been on tour, and they had been on tour with Chad Channing as their drummer at that point. And they were stopped in Madison, Wisconsin to record with Butch Vig there. And they were there for, I think, about a week or so. And they put down a bunch of tracks, a bunch of songs and everything. And then Kurt blew out his voice. And so they had to kind of shut down recording. And within that time, I think, and finishing the tour and whatnot, and then they had issues with Chad Channing. And so he kind of left the band, and then they ended up finding Dave Grohl. What they ended up doing is taking like those recordings and those tapes from that session and basically sending it around to different studios and whatnot so that they could, you know, kind of, you know, get a taste
of it. Chop it around as like a demo.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they already had Bleach at that point, but I mean, I don't know, man, you could just already, I mean, I haven't heard like those demo tapes. I think you can listen to on the special edition.
That's I would
like
hope the they have Dome for edition. $250. Yeah, they ought to give them to you on metal reels, man.
Yeah, I think you can. I think they do have at least some of the tracks on there. But dude, I think you can just tell, anybody could tell, having listened to Bleach and then listening to those demos, that
they're going.
There's a progression here, right? And that's even without like Dave Grohl on drums. You know what I mean? So I would hope, I mean, and I'm guessing somebody did, and that somebody was David Geffen, right? Or, you know, Geffen Records, essentially.
Yeah.
The David Geffen Company. Is that what it is? The DGC, David Geffen Company?
Yeah. Now, one thing I want to talk about is, so Butch Vig, now he's produced a lot of stuff, but also notably was the drummer of Garbage, which was a fairly popular 90s alternative band.
Dude, yeah, it was interesting because I never knew that. I never made that connection.
Oh, see,
until I read about it.
I did know that, but it's interesting because when I read about in the documentary, he talks about opening his studio in Madison, Wisconsin, right? Yeah. Now, aside from some of the stuff that would later go on to become Nevermind, there were some other stuff there. Now there was a lot of albums that you probably have not heard of and maybe will never hear of. But yeah. I mean, one thing that caught me as I was looking through the list, they also recorded Everclear's Sparkle and Fade there, which I mean, to me, that's a 90s album that I would scratch. That's a good one. Always been one of my favorites. There was a Soul Asylum album recorded there.
Yeah.
All the Garbage albums were recorded there.
Mm-hmm.
And then this still went on into the early 2000s.
Yeah.
So you had like other groups like Jimmy Eat World, Death Cab for Cutie, which I don't like that band. But I mean, there's just, it was interesting because I'd never heard of this studio, but there was a lot of interesting stuff that had been done there. And unfortunately they had to close down in 13, but that was kind of cool.
Well, I saw that he also, now I don't know if he was like the full producer, if they recorded the albums there, but dude, he was a producer on Gish and he was a producer on Siamese Dream as well. I don't know if it was the full album or just tracks or what the deal was, but he is credited as being a producer on those albums.
Yeah. Which is pretty cool. Cause I mean, you know, I only knew about him through through the whole connection with Garbage, and then initially watching the classic albums. But that's pretty cool to note that he was kind of a pretty prominent figure within the 90s rock scene.
Mm-hmm. Now, they went to record this once they kind of got their Geffen Records deal and everything, they went to Sound City to record this, and they were able to get Butch Vig. I think Geffen wanted, you know, another producer that they had known and worked with and everything, but you know, they stuck to their guns and they got him. And they had I think in the documentary they say it says $60,000, and then on the wiki I saw it was $65,000 to essentially do the record. I don't know where that falls, I guess, in a budget for a band.
For In Utero, they paid Albini like a flat fee of I think 200 or 250 grand.
Wow.
Okay. I think so.
Wow, that's pretty good. I mean, that's cool.
So they probably had no idea it was going to be as big as it was. Now think about, dude, how great this must be for Butch Vig in his life too, like just still getting fucking royalties from it.
Oh, dude, good for him, man.
Yeah.
So it seems like it was a, watching the documentary and then also reading and hearing a little bit, Butch Vig, he seems like he has such a very nice, like even temperament.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure as being a producer, you definitely have to, it helps to have something like that, especially dealing with someone like Kurt, who seemed rather volatile and could get grumpy. Like they even talked about, and it's talked about a lot, where, you know, sometimes Kurt wouldn't want to double things or he'd get frustrated. And, Butch had to sort of play him a little bit. And, like, as far as like doubling vocals, he would be like, "Hey man, John Lennon doubled vocals." And then Kurt would be like, "Okay, fine, I'll do it." I think he was probably, the right producer for that time. Now, I have found it a little interesting, though, and I'm curious if they really, really feel this way. But after the album was released and it became obviously the huge hit and blew up the way we all know it, the band actually said they were dissatisfied with the production of the album because it sounded too commercial. And it's like, man, I don't know. I sort of, there's a part of me that, like, looking back on it and you actually listen to the album, I'm like, okay, I can see what they're talking about. But because it does have this dirty, it does have like a, that roaring feel to it, but it's smooth and it is clean. So I do know what they're saying. And I think they basically, that this heavily influenced their next album, In Utero.
Oh, right?
I mean, so
just claustrophobic, man.
I just found that interesting for them to kind of say that and say that after the fact, because dude, it's like, you guys had to sign off on this, right?
Yeah.
Like after it was mixed and you guys listened to it, you didn't say, this sounds too commercial. We don't want it to sound like this. Let's get someone else to remix it or master it or something like that.
Yeah, true.
But I think that also goes, though, in a certain way to them as people and the generation, because all of a sudden Nevermind became cool.
Yeah, and they were just kind of like, oh, fuck this.
Yeah, and dude, it's kind of that generation. It's not cool to be cool. So yeah, you have to go against it. So that's just sort of, I found that interesting to read that.
But. Yeah, no, and I think that's all fair commentary, because, but even their bits of commentary are fair too. It has a very different sound from In Utero, for example.
100%. Yeah.
So, yep. You know what? I was gonna comment when you were talking about the doubling of vocals.
Yeah.
If I was in the producer's chair, that's an easy one. You just be like, "That was good, but I just want to get one more," and then just double them.
that's kind of Sinead O'Connor just died. That's kind of what Butch Vig did. He would say like, oh man, I kind of messed up in the studio here. I was, you know, something technically went wrong or whatever. Let's just, can we just do it again?
Yeah.
And that was sort of, it kind of sort of his attitude towards it.
So. You gotta do what you gotta do, man.
Yeah, you do.
Now, one thing I want to talk about too is the cover was always kind of controversial.
Yes, it was. And,
but the kid who was on the cover as a baby has since tried to sue Kurt Cobain's estate.
Yes. Yeah. And the judge was like, dude, fuck you.
Yeah. Now, as much as I'd have no problem with any money being taken away from Courtney Love, I also think that lawsuit was just such a bullshit money grab. Yeah. Because they talk about how he's often profited from being the Nirvana kid on the album and they call it, the Nevermind Baby. Think they might have said that he even has a tattoo of it.
Tattoo.
So yeah, he does. Really probably traumatized you, huh?
Well, what's interesting is, so on that Nirvana documentary, the classic albums, mm-hmm. I have it on DVD, and they have extras that are not included in the documentary. And one of the extras is talking about the album. They interview him and he talks about the process and like how it went down and everything. And
he wouldn't even remember.
He's all about, you know, happy. He's just happy. He's like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm the baby. Throughout the years, he's even recreated the image in the shot and everything.
Showing his wiener, too.
I don't know about that. He probably had shorts on, but, you know, probably not showing his wiener.
I think, dude, you'd want to wear like a falsie like Dirk Diggler at the end of Boogie Nights. So it's just scraping the bottom as you're swimming.
Hey, man, that kid really grew up.
Yeah.
I'd definitely be going after a $100 bill, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. One, dude. I mean, even with inflation, that exactly. Still must not have been worth shit.
Yeah. Well, Graham, should we go ahead and get into the tracks now?
Yeah, I suppose we must.
Yes. So let's go. Let's start off with the very, very well-known track number one, Smells Like Teen Spirit. It's hard to almost say anything about this track.
That I know.
Really hasn't been said. I mean, it's been, I still love the song. Like, even though it's been obviously the radio play has just been just like, you know, obviously radio, MTV, not only just then, but it's also, you know, it's just played on classic rock radio every day, multiple times a day.
Classic rock and, radio?
Yeah, dude, they would play us on 90, what would you call it? On 101.7 and stuff. Like, dude, if anything that was playing. Yeah, dude, I would hear this all the time, like with Led Zeppelin and.
That's strange. Pink Floyd, to me.
Yeah, dude, I found it to be strange, too, but they would still play. They would play some Soundgarden stuff and whatnot, too. Yeah, I'd hear it every once in a while. Yeah. It just. There were a few songs that could kind of break into
that. Well, sort because I guess you'd hear like Guns N' Roses. You'd hear some stuff from the 80s, not all the total trash, but some of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, the song is super important and, you know, always has that thing. But I always remember the aesthetic of the video being pretty trippy, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was a great video. I mean, that year, I don't know if it was MTV. I don't know if they had, did they have MTV Music Video Award? I don't think, know if they did back then. I remember there being like a best videos of the year or whatever. This was obviously very, very high up there. I think actually number one that year might have been Guns N' Roses, You Could Be Mine.
Oh, from the T2 scenes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
I always enjoyed Weird Al's parody too, called Smells Like Nirvana. Completely recreated the video, and it's awesome.
Right. Right. Well, it was Kurt's idea to do this. He had seen, there's some movie called Over the Edge, which I have not seen. And he was like, oh yeah, the kids like take over the school and they like destroy a bunch of stuff and everything. And so the guy, the music video director, he was like really hurting for a gig. He had been in LA and whatnot. Huh. And he went up to somebody and said, hey, you guys, just give me something or whatever. And nobody knew what this was going to be. So we're like, hey, go make a video for this band or whatever. And so
That's funny.
I guess he had a video all done and like ready to go and sent up to Kurt, and Kurt didn't like it because he had put sort of some other shots in there of like the principal and like other little snippets and scenes and whatnot. And Kurt was like, no. And it's funny because the guy, I forget his name, but he was like, yeah, like he's like that soon to became like a cliche thing to do. And he was like, so Kurt flew down to LA, sat in the editing bay with him, and like they finished editing it together and took out all the stuff that he didn't want. Yeah. I was like, dude, that is kind of badass.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and of course, Kurt could be a little grumpy and whatnot, but he, like after a couple of takes, he was like, he didn't want to be doing it anymore. And then, so he started getting annoyed and pissed off, and the video director had to like call the record company and basically say, hey, I don't have a video. Like I need a couple takes. And so, what is going on upstairs? Anyways, so I just thought that was pretty cool. And they said that, yeah, it was those takes kind of like at the end, how he's like kind of screaming and like coming towards the camera.
Yeah.
He goes out of focus. Like he was doing that because he was just pissed off. And like, that's what he ended up using. So
interesting.
Yeah. But anyways, yeah, dude, I still think this is just it's a fantastic song. I love it. I think it blew up and became popular for a reason. I just think the transitions are good. Great energy. Mm-hmm. And I still don't know what he's saying half the time, but I don't really care. It's like that good of a song where I'm like, whatever. And that's, that's one thing. And not just with this song, whatever, but never mind, other, bro. Yeah. Other songs on this album, they talk about like a lot of the lyrics and stuff. And for him, it was more about how the words kind of sounded like going together.
Yeah.
The vocal melody.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Wow. So Grim. Then we go to track two, In Bloom.
This one, always, dude. And this was music video was almost even better.
Yeah,
I think so, because it wasn't this like a mock on the Ed Sullivan show.
Kind of, yeah, yeah. It was like the '60s show. It was almost like the version before Weezer did Buddy Holly a little bit, right?
Yeah,
like this is like their better version of that. Which Weezer's version is still awesome, but
it's just funny because it looks like this clean cut show and they're wearing suits and then they just rip it apart. And see, now this is a classic to me example of like using that dissonance in the chord changes where it just gives it a nasty overbite kind of a sound,
Ooh, the overbite.
I like that. Or underbite.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, man, I like some of the lyrics. I love the way when he sings, like the song, starts off a little slower, but it when he sings like, spring is here again, it kind of starts this slow little buildup before it like, punches in.
And it's got a real kind of sludgy, nasty sort of movement in it. Like the way it just kind of goes. I don't know. I remember being a kid taking guitar lessons and going to my teacher and was like, I need to learn how to play this song.
Yeah, right. Dude, that's sweet, man. That's really cool. That's really cool. Track number three. These first three tracks all singles, like a 3-song run, it'd be hard to beat this, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, Come As You Are. Now, this had this, I mean, still had the heavy sound, but I think this was like, and despite that there were chilled out sections in some of the other ones, this on the whole was a much more subdued song, I think, overall. But the video was super dark and weird, and I just remember the images of that fucking gun and the line, "No, I don't have a gun." Like,
you're right.
And that just, it's like you didn't exactly know what it was about, but it seemed like it was kind of some dark shit.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people actually speculated that this song kind of was about heroin and him struggling with it, and apparently with him doing it at the time. Now, that's what I read. I mean, I don't know his, I don't have a timeline of what he used and when he used it and how much he used it. But during this time and during the recording and stuff of this album, I mean, they didn't have like any money. Like, they talked about how basically they had to play a show just so they could afford drive gas out to money LA, to drive down to L.A. So it seems to me, I mean, I guess if you're hooked on something, like, you just find a way.
You right? figure it out.
But I did find it interesting. Like, is he using? How much is he using? Were the other band members aware? You know, it's like, hey, we're down here like recording this album, and you're, you know, doing heroin, man. We need, you know, we can't have that. Yeah. Like, I would be curious to know like what his use sort of was like back then. Anyways,
yeah.
Track number 4, Breed. This actually might be my favorite track on the album.
Really? Oh, I like it. I've always liked it, but okay.
I think I like it because it's just straightforward and balls to the wall. Yeah, right? Like, it's just like, I don't care. Like, dude, it's not a hit, right? Like it's funny because of the first 5 tracks, it's the only one that's not a single. And even a song like Polly, I feel like has become kind of like this fan favorite a little bit, because it has, I don't know if it's a mystique about it, but I think people really, a lot of fans really like it. So I just feel like it's just kind of funny. The Breed is just kind of like stuck in here in this place.
Yeah.
But I really just, you know, it is, you know, the changes are pretty simple. And, you know, when you do listen to it though, like, listening to it now and thinking about, you know, some of the, I guess, poppy changes and feel, it can almost be sometimes a little comical to listen to when you're just like, I feel like I'm like, oh man, I could hear like a band like the Birds in the 60s, like doing this and like slowing it down.
Yeah.
You know, slowing it down is like this kind of jingle, right? Like,
yeah, sure.
I don't know, man. I just think that. So, what do you got anything on that, or you want to move on?
No, I don't have anything to add to it. I think it's a pretty good description of it. I've also always liked the song, but you're right. It is the only one of the first 5 that was not a single.
I'm so happy, cause today found my friends in my head. I'm so ugly, that's okay, cause so are you.
And I remember number 5 kind of hooking me in as a kid, Lithium. And that sounded like a drug use sort of song.
Title implied.
But I think isn't Lithium an antidepressant?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm sure it is something that could probably be abused.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to look just because, man, but I think it's like a straw. I gotta look. Hold on.
Yeah. Okay. while you're looking that up, essentially the song is about what Kurt said. It's like a fictionalized account of a man who he turns to religion as a last resort to keep himself alive after the death of his girlfriend to keep him from suicide. So,
oh, wow.
Definitely a like heavy sort of subject matter.
Well, dude, they use lithium as it says that it's used as a maintenance drug to treat bipolar disorder and stabilize mood and prevent manic episodes. So that's
a thing. Whatever it is, it sounds strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds like if you took it, it would affect you. At least that's sort of its
especially its if you purpose. Didn't need it. That's the thing.
Yeah. Right. There's that too.
Yeah.
I think the one thing with this song is, you know, they have a lot of obvious, you know, their transitions, but this one I feel like has some really deep peaks in valleys.
Yeah,
you know, it starts off very
they do a good job of that, like throughout, when you think about a lot of these songs now. I mean, yeah, there are a lot of dynamic change in them.
We move on to track number 6, Polly. You know, this definitely slows the album down. It's, you know, kind of more that, I guess, you know, acoustic based song. Like, I don't know. I just always feel like a lot of fans like this song. What's your kind of take on it? I mean,
It's dark. It was okay. I think it's about rape.
So essentially the story goes is, I think Kurt read about this, is that a young woman at a theater, I don't know if it was a show, like a concert, was kidnapped and tortured. And she came on to the guy who kidnapped her. And what that did was that let his guard down.
Mm.
And that's when she got away. And so Kurt in this song takes the view of the torturer. So again, very dark, but interesting sort of subject matter.
You know, isn't Polly the only one that they used some of the tracks that they recorded in Wisconsin from?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if it was, I don't know what, but it says this is the one song they recorded in Madison that made it onto the album. So I don't know if it's all the tracks, part of the tracks.
Okay.
I don't know if this is, you know, I'm not really sure.
I can't remember if it's, does Polly get heavier? Is this version just all acoustic?
I think it's all acoustic.
Yeah, because I've definitely heard, it might be on Muddy Banks of Wishco where they have like a heavier version of it.
Yeah, I know they definitely played this one live. They also played this one on
Unplugged,
I believe. Yes, Unplugged, I believe, which makes sense. Now, Graham, we get to the best song on the album.
Dude.
Track number 7, Territorial Pissings.
Oh, so awesome.
Come on, people now. Smile on your brother. Everybody get together. Try to love one another right now.
Come on, people now.
Yeah, I like that.
What song? Who sings that in the 60s? What song is that?
I don't know, but
it escapes me.
Yeah, maybe is that the Association?
It could be.
I don't know, but yeah.
Somebody let us know.
Yeah, below after you go ahead and
subscribe and comment below.
One thing that I do love about Kurt is the raspiness that he has in his vocals, and I just think it's just awesome on this track.
Yeah.
This, to me, this actually might be, it might be almost the most In Utero track on the album. Like, I feel like it if they would have put it on In Utero with some of those production techniques and things that they were doing to get a less polished sound. I feel like this is one track that could have kind of made it on there. It's definitely, a lot of the songs on this album are dark. I feel like this one is definitely on the angry and dark, makes sense.
It was the Youngbloods, mate.
Oh, the Youngbloods. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, did they have been? I wonder if they had any other hits.
Well, they actually do a version of the rest of Territorial Pissing. No, that would be awesome.
Yeah. Dude, that would be awesome, man. If they played a live show and you thought they were going to play like their version and then they just played Territorial Pissings.
Yeah. Dude,
that would be sweet, man.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah. When I was an alien, man.
Yeah. When I was an alien. That's good. All right, Grim, moving on to track number 8, Drain You.
One baby to another says I'm lucky to meet you.
One baby to another said, I'm lucky to meet you.
Yes. Butch Vig said that this track has the most guitar overdubs on the album. There's one clean track and I guess 5 distorted tracks.
Whoa.
Yeah. They kept like it just wasn't sounding like, I think Kurt said it just wasn't sounding heavy enough and heavy enough. And so this is one of those instances that Butch had to sort of, I think, trick Kurt and be like, okay, well, no, let's do another take of that. Let's do it. And he just started layering like guitars over and over on this track. One thing I did find interesting is that, you know, this song has sort of this middle section, and they said what inspired it was the Who's Won't Get Fooled Again.
Interesting. Yeah.
And dude, once I heard that in this song, I just couldn't unhear it. Like, it was like so obvious at that point. Cause you know, Won't Get Fooled Again just kind of does have that point where they're just kind of like, I don't even know what they're doing. Yeah.
Isn't this the one where it starts with those weird chords and then it sounds like they do like hand farts or something?
I think that's probably about right.
I think it is. Yeah.
One baby or another.
So, next one starts out with just the bass, and that is Lounge Act.
Not to be confused with Lounge Fly.
Now, I like how on the first run through a Lounge Act, he sings it just in his normal voice.
Yes.
But then when he comes in the second time, he's just yelling it as loud as he can.
Right. You know, though, I think this might be the only track where on this album that he's like really in his normal voice. Like it sounds so clear and
Polly?
No, Lounge Act.
I guess Polly, it's almost more like intentionally subdued. But you're right. He's singing like very forthright, but not yelling and not being intentionally subdued, similar to something in the way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. He's not catatonic and he's not overly raspy. So, it's just interesting to hear him. And then the second half,
he lets it rip.
He does. But he does, you know, but when he goes to I'm on a plane, like you get that, you know, the back of the throat. Right.
Yeah, that's true. But I like this. It has the right amount of dissonance for me. And like the way it picks up in that second verse is pretty awesome.
Right.
But it is very similar to song 10, which is Stay Away. Not I Stay Away by Alice in Chains. Could have been a great, great songs of the same name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would have been.
Because Alice in Chains is that puts up a good fight. That's a good
one. Oh, dude, I love that song.
I know.
I really like it I like the recorded version, but I really like how they do it on Unplugged.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Monkey see, monkey do. Anyways, Stay Away, man. Yeah. I feel like this could actually be another In Utero song.
I could see that.
I just feel like it has that kind of overall kind of almost a, I don't know if I would say disjointed, but sort of a disjointed feel to it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So that's where I go there. You want to get on a plane with track number 11, Graham?
Dude, always like this one a lot.
Without any words, I got so high, scratched till I bled, love myself,
weird lyrics, but I like the one he said, the finest day that I ever had was when I learned how to cry on demand.
Dude, that's pretty sweet, man. Because I feel like, again, not to like, you know, overanalyze or anything, but you're like, man, think about all the people who, you know, mm-hmm. who like do that. It's like, oh, I do that and I got the attention. Oh,
yeah, okay, yeah.
Cool. Like it worked.
Love myself better than you.
Better than you, dude. You know, I mean, I like, what is he, what else did he say? Yeah. What the hell am I trying to say? Cause he was like, he was writing the lyrics, like right, pretty much right before he went in to record them. And so I think that kind of led to that line, but yeah, I'm on a plane. I can't complain. I always love that sort of play on words a little bit.
And then the play on words with the spelling, because you would, when, if you say I'm on a plane, you naturally think of a plane that is flying as opposed to a flat piece of land.
The land. Yes, exactly. You know, he did say that after this song was done or it came out, he wasn't really happy with the recording. He said it was way too clean and they should have, you know, made it more raw.
A little less polished.
Yeah. I think
a little more claustrophobic.
He likes that how they do it live better. So, which is, you know, it's one of those instances though, man. It's like, dude, they went down there for, I don't even know how long it took to record this album.
It wasn't that long.
And dude, like if you're still like putting the song together, like finishing lyric, like you're basically working with songs that are not complete. So you haven't had time to just like sort of polish them on your end and everything. And
so don't blame Butch for that one.
Yeah, Kurt.
That is Kurt.
Yep. Track number 12, Grim. Something in the Way.
Something.
One thing I'm not sure if you are aware of. Do you know who's also credited with
or uncredited?
Then you do. All right.
Mark Lanegan.
And did you read?
I don't know the story as to why.
Okay. So essentially, Nick Oliveri, who was in Queens of the Stone Age with Mark Lanegan for a time. And there's a novel. Maybe it is out in 2023. There's a book just called Lanegan, and Nick Oliveri basically says, Mark said he wrote some lyrics on Something in the Way with Kurt on Nevermind, but Kurt had played on some of Mark's solo stuff, The Winding Street. So instead of getting paid, they just did this thing where, hey man, I added a lyric on your song and you added a lyric on my song. Let's call it even.
God, I wish he was. Yeah. Betty wish he would have taken the songwriting credits on that one.
Yeah, well, that's what Oliveri then says. He told the author that he remembered Lanegan kicking himself in the butt a little bit about that, knowing that he would have made a lot of money off songwriting credit. So
that's interesting.
But this is always, it's interesting how this was recorded. Did you read about that and everything? Or do you remember that from the documentary?
Yeah, when he was just like laying on the couch in the control room.
Yeah, because they couldn't get it. They tried it like in the studio. And then Kurt like lays down on the couch. I feel like that's such almost like a movie or Hollywood thing to do. He's like, oh, he just lays down on the couch. He's like, no, I want to record it like this. And then he starts playing it.
That actually sounds to me like something Gorman would have done.
Yes. Yeah. Or something like
you. 100%.
Yeah. No, I could definitely see that.
I like how the strings come into this, and it just is a very different thing.
Yes. Very, very. It's a very intense song. And, you know, I think a lot of people have probably tried to break it down.
Unless you're a fish, that's why it's okay to eat them, because they don't have any feelings.
Exactly.
Now, I think this is the point where I want to talk about some of this business with the hidden track. I'm going to air quote that one with Endless and Nameless, because give me the rundown about what you said about how this worked, because I have something that I think counters it.
Okay. So my understanding is that after the initial pressing of CDs.
The initial first impressing.
Yeah. After the initial pressing, they did not include this hidden track. And so I believe the first pressing in the US was about, I think, just over 40,000 CDs. And then I think they sent about 35 over to the UK because Bleach did well in Europe. And Kurt got whatever, he had his copy, and then they listened to it and noticed that this song, Endless Nameless, was not on there. And he was like, WTF. And so they ended up, you know, he called the guy who mastered it and whatnot and was like, hey, dude, you got to put this on there. And the guy, basically, he thinks he said like it was just a mistake. Like, you know, he either forgot or the record, like he was given a note and maybe he just forgot about it or whatever. But essentially, something in the way plays, and then there's about 10 minutes of silence, and then this song, Endless Nameless, plays. And so the total track is 2035. Now, that was supposedly starting to be included after the first pressing, but it sounds like that may not have been the case as far as you know.
Dude.
For you.
Yeah. I am certain, 100% certain, that I did not get this album as soon as it came out. I can tell you that there is no way I would have ever got that first run of CDs. Yeah. I was 10 years old.
It probably also, there's a good chance that first run didn't even make it to Michigan. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. But what I can tell you is that I've had this album. I have the CD. And it's not on there, dude, because I took my entire CD collection, and as soon as, you know, iTunes came along, I put all my CDs on iTunes so I would have them. And yep. I looked back to verify it, and it is not there. Yeah. And anyone who knows, like, you could, you know, it's not like you could put a song into iTunes and, like, trim it.
Yeah, like, that didn't happen.
No.
And because Something in the Way, essentially the total length of it would be 20 minutes and 35 seconds.
Well, and even if they only wrote the 352 on the back, because that's what a lot of people would do, right, is they would write on the back what the length was, and then it'd just keep playing. And if you were an adventurous little feller, you might find the hidden track.
Exactly. Well, and that's the thing. And again, people, please let us know. Like, do we have some? I know, that's what my iTunes and Apple Music says as well, because I put the CD in and I remember buying it probably even years later, whatever copy I put in or I got it from you. Now, I find it interesting. I'd like to know, do we have like a different version? Because I know I don't have the first run version of it. I just know that's the deal.
Looking at all the artwork for the back, it does not list times.
Okay.
So that's just interesting to know. Not that that matters, but it's just, you know, as I looked at it does not really list times. So that's kind of a funny little thing. Cause I honestly listening to Endless Nameless now, because, it was just easier for me to listen to it via streaming in preparation for today's episode. Dude, when I heard Endless Nameless, I was kind of like, whoa, I don't know what this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And no, it's nasty. It could have been an in utero song.
In utero. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's kind of what I was thinking too. So I mean, for our purposes, I'm still going to count that as a separate track and not as a, like,
I'm actually not going to count it on the album.
Okay.
Like for me, it's not even in the running because, dude, and I don't think we're the only ones here. I just think, dude, for most people growing up, that didn't exist.
Because the thing is I don't remember anyone talking about
no.
it. Like,
I don't remember hearing it. When I heard it, it was like listening to it for the first time. It was.
Right. Yeah. As kids, you would always be like, oh, man, dude, did you hear the secret track? There's a hidden track.
It's like knowing a passcode
or a secret to like
to Mike Tyson's Punch Out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because I want to get back to Bald Bull. I don't want to have to go through Piston Honda, Don Flamenco, King Hippo.
All that.
And Don Flamenco the second time just to get there.
Just don't.
But
All right.
So Graham. I'm not counting that one. Scratching protocol. Now, what are we going to scratch this with?
Ooh, I don't know. Probably a needle, Grim.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. Or now, how about a fish hook? Like the one that Dollar Bill, that the little boy was chasing in the pool.
That's fair enough, man. That's fair
I
enough.
Think since I was on the tee last time.
I think I was on the tee last time.
That's incorrect, my friend. We just did last time.
Okay. All right.
Unless we're doing like Pulp Fiction and we're not releasing things in the order in which they were recorded.
Who's to say at this point, man? Who's to say? All right. Yeah, fair. All right. Fine. You want me to go?
I do.
All right. So my favorite track, even though here's the thing, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't think it's the best track, but my favorite track is Breed. Like,
no, that's mentioned that. Yeah, I would have to say. Oh, are we doing favorite and then scratch or both favorites first?
Yeah, that's fine. You can go with your favorite. What's your favorite?
I still, even after all these years, it's got to be In Bloom, because that chord sequence was just always struck me as so odd and cool.
Okay. Yeah, not gonna split hairs on that one. All right, man. This one was a tough one to scratch for me.
Yeah, it is. They all are.
Yeah, they all are. I mean, that's the thing. That's why it's hard. But like, I just feel like the first, to me, you know, the first half of the album is so strong, because like the first five tracks are all singles, and Breed is like my favorite song. So it's like, man, it's like hard to scratch anything from there.
Yeah.
I actually go with Stay Away.
Okay.
Again, like the whole monkey see, monkey do. I kind of never really liked that part. I do feel like this song has elements where it would potentially sound better on like In Utero. Like, I just feel like it's got this. I don't know, just kind of like more raw guttural sound to it. And so that's kind of why I went with Stay Away.
Fair enough.
Okay. What do you got, Grim?
Well, I'm sure I'm going to get called out on this one by a lot of people. But, dude, and it's only and honestly, I can't even blame the radio or MTV, because I even told you that I made a tape where this song was just over and over and over. And it smells like Teen Spirit, man. And not because it's not a great and important song, just throw it out there now.
What the fuck is that?
Such a hater, man.
No, and it's not. It's just because I ruined that one for myself, and I just listened to it so much that when I listened to this record, I would want to listen to kind of the other tracks that I didn't, you know, just beat the piss out of.
Just want to listen to Endless Nameless is such a new track for you. You probably just want to repeat the shit out of that, I bet, don't you?
Actually, oh, damn, they still could get that on a vinyl, because I was actually hoping that.
Oh, it's not included. FYI, good. It's not included on the vinyl.
Good. I did, and it shouldn't be.
Yep.
And it shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be.
So.
Interesting. All right. Well,
let us know.
People are going to have some real Chris Hughes with that track. No, I understand from like, okay, it's just like, I mean, it's like people who would want to scratch Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah. Because it's like, not dude. That it's not a great song. It's just, you've heard it so much. I kind of want to listen to the other songs more.
Like, dude, like you could also make the argument like, dude, Nirvana ended up hating that song.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
So, yeah. I mean, so there is that. I mean, shit, Nirvana, for kind of what they've even said at points, hated this album.
They just scratched the whole album.
Yeah. Like, ah, fuck it. Yes. So,
let us know what you would do below.
Yeah.
And remember, don't be the person saying it's perfect. I wouldn't scratch anything, because if you learned anything from former President John F. Kennedy, it should be what he said about the space race, and that is, we don't do things because they are easy. We do them because they are hard.
Exactly. Damn, that's
You like that?
Yeah, I didn't think JFK would ever work his way into our channel, but he certainly did. So yeah. Words to live by. Words to live by. All right,
you're
everyone.
Welcome. You're
Thank
welcome.
You for watching. Very exciting to have you here. Give us a like and subscribe. It's time to go on the Doom Crew Show.
Scratch a Track is produced by the Doom Grim. Additional music provided by Moore and the Tings. Copyright 2023, The Doom Grim Show.